In August, I went to a soil biology presentation in Mora delivered by Dr. Christine Jones. She began by talking about how the land would have looked in pre-colonial WA and Australia. The evidence, gathered from writers, diarists, explorers and painters of the time, describe a summer landscape rich with carpets of perennial grasses. From this, regeneratively minded folk today, determined to bring growing activities back into natural cycles, are talking up the logic of year-round ground cover. Here's a quote from one of Christine's online papers from her website, amazingcarbon.com. "The most meaningful indicator for the health of the land and the long-term wealth of a nation is whether soil is being formed or lost. If soil is being lost, so too is the economic and ecological foundation on which production and conservation are based. In little over 200 years of European settlement, more than 70% of Australian agricultural land has become seriously degraded. Despite efforts to implement best practice in soil conservation, the situation continues to deteriorate. On average, 7 tonnes of topsoil is lost for every tonne of grain produced. This situation has worsened in recent years due to an increased incidence of erosion on unprotected topsoils coupled with declining yields. After harvest, the conventional methods of farming dictates that the earth is left with stubble and eventually sprayed with a herbicide to discourage plants from emerging, as it is considered that they denude the soil of water and decrease fertility. So ingrained is this thinking that it feels counterintuitive to allow plants to simply grow after harvest, especially as the soils in the paddocks have become so acidic after years of repeated chemical applications that the plants most likely to appear are, of course, weeds. Weeds are better than nothing, Christine advised, a place to start if you're transitioning to a more nature-based farming approach. Di and Ian Haggerty from Wild Catchem were in the audience. They've been experimenting with regenerative practices over several decades and shared their experiences. After harvest, they leave the paddock to its own devices and have found that after years of being chemical-free and many homegrown compost tea applications, the native perennials are actually returning in force. These are plants that have not been seen in such numbers for decades, so they're actually looking for help from Aboriginal elders and botanists to put a name to them. Perennials tend to have deeper root systems than annuals that enables them to tough out over the summer months, keeping the biology ticking over, the ecosystem intact and the soils alive with microbes. Just like the old days, I mean the old, old days, our colonial forebears were growing crops without the use of chemicals, but clearing practices and applied European know-how was enough to destroy natural systems balance, and the damage was done widely and early. The Haggerty's land is an advanced regenerative practice. For a farmer trying to make a transition away from chemicals, weeds might be the first necessary step following the understanding that if you lose green cover, you're losing soil carbon. Christine's revelation for me was that biodiversity is the key, literally. After the late spring harvest, if a farmer sows over 8 or 9 species, there is a chance, given a bit of encouraging spring and summer rain, that they will see a rich carpet of varieties emerge. Experiments have shown that there's a tipping point, a magic number of species. Under 8 or 9, the paddock be unlikely to bloom, but at 8 or 9, magic. Another farmer, Nick Kelly from Newdigate, told us of his experimentations with summer green cover crops. He uses clovers, vetches, other grains, chickpeas and flaxseed. When questioned, he suggested getting bird seed, basically whatever's cheap and available. The Haggertys confirm what Christine suggests, that ultimately, if you have biodiversity and developing soil biology, the nitrogen-fixing seeds are not a necessity and can be left out of the mix, as all healthy plants will bring nitrogen to the soil. As the nitrogen fixers, like clovers and lupins, are more expensive than other seed, this is something to think of. The next day we travelled from Mora to a farm in Dandaragan for the hands-on part of the presentation, and I saw Seradella clover and chickpeas growing. I was enchanted by the chickpeas with their lovely feathery leaves, and when I got home went straight to the supermarket and bought a packet and started soaking them. Not only did I make a nice batch of hummus, But a few days later they sprouted, and I put them in a neglected area of the backyard that had been up until that point spectacularly greened up with marshmallow, the odd nettle and warrigal greens. Over the last few years I'd collected a bunch of favourite seeds, alfalfa, rocket, broccoli, mitsuna, coriander, bok choy, and now added flax from the health food store, relying on this patch to deliver the required numbers of species by the reappearance of warrigal greens and nettles. I await results from this hitherto unpromising patch of dirt. Apparently, flax is a wondrous plant for the creation of fungi, and ultimately, the long, skinny fungi strands visible under the microscope are the microbes that are needed to create the most fertile of soils. I soaked the flax seed overnight, and it created the same glutinous, jelly-like environment that chia does and was hard to handle. Next time, I'll try the unsoaked and see if I get results. And while I'm thinking of gelatinous seed, I might plant some chia that is sitting neglected in my breakfast cereal zone in the cupboard. Another superfood bites the dust. Christine Jones told a story that had a huge impact in the room. In 2011, there was a global carbon sink anomaly where CO2 levels dropped by 20% globally. The cause was traced to an event in Australia. When Christine investigated, she found it was due to a period of rain that led to extensive flooding across inland areas in New South Wales and parts of Victoria. The resulting growth of grasses led to the massive measurable carbon sink of 2011. Further evidence that grass growth across the rangelands can have a huge effect on carbon capture and subsequently climate conditions. And again on this subject, I found a piece on the internet where a bunch of scientists and other problem solvers decided to evaluate what actions would have the most impact on climate change. It's called Project Drawdown, and it makes for really interesting reading. The first one is refrigerant management. Every refrigerator and air conditioner contains chemical refrigerants that absorb and release heat to enable chilling. So they got rid of the CFCs, and this stopped depleting the ozone layer in 1987. The problem is that HFCs, the primary replacement, spare the ozone layer but have 1,000 to 9,000 times greater capacity to warm the atmosphere than carbon dioxide. Number 6, interestingly enough, is educating girls. Number 11 is where regenerative agriculture sits. Also in the top 10 are eating a plant-rich diet, reducing food waste, and leaving remaining tropical forests intact. It is so hard to align conventional with regenerative ways of thinking in terms of agriculture. They are poles apart. You are conversing across an abyss. The idea that the soil, if supported with microbial activity and diverse plantings, can create healthy ecosystems and plants that are able to resist pests and diseases, balance soil pH, and reduce the effect of frost and dry periods is simply not graspable for farmers used to bypassing natural systems by boosting with inorganic fertilisers and applying herbicides and pesticides. The atmosphere is 78% nitrogen. In the early 1900s, a German chemist called Haber worked out how to take nitrogen from the atmosphere and turn it into a product that could be bagged up and sold to farmers as an instant nitrogen fertility fix. The thing is, nitrogen is a very stable gas with triple bonded N molecules that are extremely hard to break. And it took another German man, Bosch, another 5 years to work out how to scale up the process Haber had developed to create fertilizer plants capable of churning out mass product. By World War I, they were pumping and able to use the nitrates created to feed into their farm armament industry. The Haber-Bosch method is still the go for the production of inorganic fertilizer. The process required to blast the nitrogen molecules apart is extremely energy hungry. Huge temperatures and high pressures are required. In fact, it takes such an enormous amount of fossil fuel energy to produce fertilizers that plants are often positioned on or near gas fields. To produce, transport, and apply 1 ton of synthetic nitrogen fertilizer requires an amount of energy equal to almost 2 tons of gasoline. This from Darren Qualman, a Canadian analyst and social thinker. Modern agriculture is increasingly a system for turning fossil fuel calories into food calories. Food is increasingly a petroleum product. That's the industrial agricultural story of the last 100 years, the one we're now trying to leave behind. The interesting thing is that plants, given sun, water, soil and good microbiology, meaning the full complement of bacteria, fungi, flagellates, protozoas, algae, cilia, etc., that live and work in the rhizosphere around root systems, can fix nitrogen from the atmosphere without any help from German chemists or industrial processes. It's a form of alchemy. It's astonishing when you think of the destruction humans have to institute to mimic those same processes that happen in natural self-regulating cycles. Christine called her presentation Harvesting Light. It says it all. The same alchemy exists in the making of bones. Consider that calcium and phosphorus make bones, and something bone-like can be approximated by industrial processes, but again at very high temperatures. How can it be that bones are made in the human body, naturally, at the sedate temperature of 36.1 to 37.2 degrees centigrade? Stuart McAlpine, a WA farmer and innovator, stated, and I paraphrase, "The intelligence in the natural system and genetic diversity will eventually collapse any chemical regime. No matter what you throw up against problems, if you're operating against the laws of nature, you are going to get smashed. Nature abhors a vacuum, and if you repeatedly strip the earth of its capacity to thrive, nature will grow its own defensive cover crop. In central Victoria, I observed this. In response to wild-scale clearing, the land commandeered dense thickets of blackberries to cover all the waterways and creeks. Where this had been stripped back, fierce thistles appeared, and if they were in turn attacked, prickly gorse, one of the toughest, most uncompromising of plants, colonised the land. The only way humans could win, in inverted commas, this battle of wills, was to turn the earth into dirt so barren that nothing, not even anaerobic bacteria and weeds, could survive." I went to a talk in Perth recently by Jeff Powell. He talked about Southampton Homestead, a small family farm of 120 acres producing pasture-raised chickens and ducks from paddock to plate, WA's first regenerative, truly pasture-raised poultry enterprise. Jeff and his partner Michelle began regenerating the land from a pine plantation, re-establishing perennials using natural succession of crops and grazing animals to affect the changes. In 2013, a bushfire swept through Ballinup, devastating his paddocks and damaging the house. Jeff described the second regeneration. First came the blackberries. He slashed them back. Then came the thistles. He slashed them back. Within a few seasons, the perennials had started to appear and full pasture was restored relatively quickly, enabling the business to rebuild using the chickens and other animals moving regularly across the paddocks as restorers and builders of carbon in the soil. The reality is that huge input costs and growing problems of infertility and intractable resistance to herbicides and insecticides are driving farmers to either give up their farms or change their practices. Brent Burns, owner of Landsave Organics, are an organic compost and compost tea-making mob based in Vass. He's been inundated with clients looking for the new way forward, but he only takes on those who are on the same page. If the mindset isn't right, it's simply not worth the hassle. He's not interested in tinkering around the edges. He wants to work with the entire new game. And he likes to work with his clients from start to finish. First up, he has the client look at their soil under a microscope and then look at biologically rich soil under a microscope to introduce them to the world of microbes. He knows the science and makes it easy to understand, and to him it's about love. Fungi, he says, is like a big suitcase full of love for your soil. 1 cubic metre of his worm compost sells for $2,000 and will act as an inoculant for the seed over 800 hectares. He uses worm castings as the basis for his compost teas by suspending some compost in water that is aerated by being stimulated by a pump over a 24-hour period. Depending on whether he wants a fungi, bacteria or protozoa mix, rich mix, he might add small amounts of molasses or seaweed or fish meal to get the right microbes. When ready, a spray contractor comes and picks up the liquid to be sprayed on paddocks that day. Timing is everything, as tea this alive can only survive out of an aerobicised solution for 24 hours, needs to go straight to the soil. Every farm is different, and every farm needs different treatment. Brent, we create drought by our land chemical management. Many wheat belt farmers are trying to grow crops on paddocks that have been so stripped of life that they're running on under 1% of carbon. Brent again. The thing is, if you're running on about 2% carbon, you have unproductive borderline dirt. 2.5% is just workable. Until you get more carbon in your soil, there isn't much you can do. A lot of people, the chemical hydroponic farmers, are cutting their stubble, but their stubble doesn't break down. So you might get 8, 9, 10 months with stubble still sitting there. So they go through and burn it, which heats the soil profile up and kills all remaining microbes. Brent's been working with a farm in Muckenbuden. The farmer had less than 1% carbon in his soil. You can't spray compost over 13,500 hectares, so they utilised his existing stubble. He got them to cut the stubble slightly higher. At 3 to 4 centimetres, the plant kept on working and throwing its exudates back to the root, feeding the biology until eventually it dies. At Muckenbuden, it used to take 10 to 11 months for the stubble to break down. Now, with a combination of actions, we've got it down to 3 months and it's gone. We've actually taken that stubble, so we've got somewhere to start to build carbon in the soil. Regenerative farmers like the Kellys at Newdigate are an example of a success story. Their paddocks are now sitting up to 3.5 to 4% of carbon. Now coming under the umbrella name of regenerative agriculture, biological farming is the missing link between pre-industrial agricultural European styles of farming, Aboriginal land management and organic farming practices. And cradled within this respect for natural cycles in Australia is the built-in need to connect with the first peoples of this land. It's a win-win. At the Dowran Field Day in the Wheat Belt on the 28th of August, Regen WA was launched by Alana McTiernan, the Minister of the Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development. Alana, who it is said has become a convert to regen agriculture by reading Charles Massey's The Call of the Reed Warbler, launched the group. It's a collaboration between Perth NRM, Natural Resource Management, Food Futures WA and Sustainable Agriculture. This Regen WA promises to be a great network to help connect growers across WA. I'll let Brent from Landcare Organics have the last word. Love your soils and they will love you back.